And it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Genzel back. Dr. Genzel, I believe you are the first or second class graduate of Yoad Tzor Halakha.
I actually was the first graduate of Yoad Tzor.
You are the first graduate before Dina Zimmerman or with
no,
Dina.
No, we were Chavrus apart. We Chavrus were learning
apart. Chavrus. This is the first. Yeah, so really a pioneer, I must say. The Yoad Tzor Baruch Hashem is growing leaps and bounds. So wonderful. She headed the program at Bar Ilan University of Women's Beit Midrash, and now I believe at Bar Ilan. She wrote a sefer on Yechezkel, lots more, but since we're only half an hour, we're going to let Dr. Genzel begin her shir. B'vakasha. Mi Yerushalayim, bat Banglit.
That's true. Okay, so first of all, it's really a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank you, Rabbi Kalman, for inviting me. This virtual Beit Midrash of yours is really fantastic, and to see here so many participants from all over the world really is something that, I don't want to say good things came out of the corona, but to a certain extent, good things came out of the corona, too. Since they told me 28 minutes, I'm going to go further and do it without any more introductions. And I want to say that I called this to you, mother and son, father and daughter. I hope you see the sheet I shared here, A Journey Through the Torah Readings and Haftarot of Rosh Hashanah, because actually it's one of the holidays that I feel that as a woman and as a mother and as a daughter, we're all of a sudden brought to the forefront. And I'll say that really, if I would take in a glimpse into the biblical stories that have to do with fathers, then we would hear of the daughter of Yiftach, and we might hear of Michal, the daughter of Shaul, and we might actually feel a little bit of ambivalency towards the relationship of father-daughter. But and we are talking about a family that, you know, families in the ancient Mesopotamian world that had very clear hierarchy within them. But even though and throughout that setting, I want to say why our haftarot actually have a very glowing difference to them. And they really pass us from a personal level to a national level. And I said we would go through a brief journey, and that's what we'll do. So the first Torah portion, and I'll just say maybe one more comment. We're going to look at both of Kriyot HaTorah and both of Torah. I'm allowing myself actually to skip the maftirim that have to do with the korbanot. So this is not to say that there's no maftirs in Rosh Hashanah. It's just to say that I'm doing the Kriyot, the Haftarot, and the Korbanot, somewhere I'm leaving for someone else. But, so if we look at the first Torah portion, then we're looking at Vashem Parkad Etzara, Kasher Amar, Vayas Hashem Lesara Kasher Diber. These translations are all off Safaria. I'm taking no credit. I tried to start correcting them. I gave up. I went back to Safaria's version. One day, native English speakers, I suggest you to a joint project of improving Safaria's translations. But until then, I'm giving it here in both languages as I was told, but I'm going to move forward. So Sarah has a son, and here you can see I put here three dots. And the first thing we meet, also within the Haftarah is Vatomer le'Avraham, Garesh ha'ama hazot ve'etna ki lo yirash ben ha'ama hazot mi'Yitzchak. And you ask ourselves, Haftarah of Rosh Hashanah. We heard that Yitzchak was born. And now the first thing or the second thing we're going to hear in the Haftarah is Sarah's response to Hagar and Ishmael, her son, after having her baby. And not only to us it sounds awkward, it also sounds awkward apparently to Avraham, because Avraham replies, no, he's very, very distressed. But Hashem interferes and says, "Vayomer Elohim el Avraham, it shouldn't sound so bad to you. Al anar ve'al amatecha, kol asher tomar alecha Sara shma bekola. Do everything Sara tells you. Ve'gam et ben ha'ama hazot asimenu kizarechahu. And don't worry, you will see that Ishmael will also end up being a nation. I recognize that he's your son." And Avraham wakes up the next morning, and this is all part of our haftarah, and he gives Hagar some basic needs, and he sends her to the desert. And I want to suggest that if we read this haftarah against the Code of Hammurabi, which was then the civil law, we might have a better context also for understanding Sarah's reaction, Abraham's reaction, and God's reaction, and then giving us a better context for our haftarah of Rosh Hashanah. So I chose out of the Code of Hammurabi just 146, 147, 170, and 171. This is a law code that was common knowledge in the Mesopotamian world at that time. For lack of time, I won't give any more information, but it's all available on Google. The Code of Hammurabi, number 146, says like this. It was written in Akkadian, but it's translated here into English. If a man takes a wife, and she gives this man a maid servant as wife, and she bear him children, okay, that's very similar to what we have. Sarah gave Abraham Hagar, and she had a child, Ishmael. And then this maid assumed equality with his wife, because she has born children. Her master should not sell her for money. So what we see here is that there's a certain status that's acceptable that we can discuss when a servant is given a child to the master. And what does he say very specifically? You can choose if she's equal or not, but what you cannot do is you can in no way sell anymore this woman maid that has now a child, that bared you a child for money. But he may keep her as a slave, but also not necessarily. He could either give her equal status or he could keep her as a slave. Number 147 tells us if she has not born a child, then she can sell her for money. Meaning what we understand is that once Hagar had a child, she's now saved from being sold. But that's not the end. I'm skipping to 170. If his wife bears a son to a man, which is what happened to Sarai years come later, and also Yitzchak was born, or his maidservant had born sons, and the father, and this is my emphasis, while still living, says to the children whose his maidservant has born, my son, and he count them with the sons of his wife. If then the father dies, then the sons of the wife and the maidservant shall divide the paternal property in common. Meaning, there is a question of what status did the father give the children when he was alive. If when he was alive, he treated both sons equally, then it means that after he passes away, these sons get to get equal status and get equal property. But notice number 100 said 71, and here I also emphasize the words. If, however, the father, while still living, did not say to the sons of the maidservants, my sons, meaning he continued to recognize that they're second bests, that they're the maidservants, and then the father dies, then the sons of the maidservants should not share with the sons of the wife, but the freedom of the maid and her sons shall be granted. Sons of the wife shall have no right to enslave, and then you can see the law goes on. I want to say something that I think is very substantial here. I'll stop the chair for a minute. If we go according to the Hammurabi Code at that time, then what we're looking at is two patterns or two paths for these children, for Yitzchak and Ishmael. Pattern one says that Avraham gave them equal status and deserved them equally, and now, after 100 and after Mea Veslim, like we say, after Abraham will pass away, they will be equal. But if Abraham, when he was alive, made it clear that there's a hierarchy here and made sure that the son of the slave stays as a son of the slave can't be sold, he can't sell his son, but it's clear that there's a master and there's a slave. What does Sarah actually request when she requests this very harsh request that we hear in the Haftarah that was hard for Avraham to accept? She's basically telling Avraham, listen, everyone sees you acting equally to both your sons. This wasn't the deal I signed in for. I said specifically, now that I have a son, this will be the head of Am Yisrael. You have to make a clear declaration before you pass away that there's a hierarchy between your two sons, and my son is the one that's considered. You can call him the master. You can call him the head of Am Yisrael. You can call him Ki Yitzchak Yikare Lechazera. Whatever you want to call it, make it clear. Now, Avraham, apparently this wasn't obvious to him. How do I know this wasn't obvious and that he was ambivalent and it's hard for him to make this a hierarchy laid out? Because it says here, no, it was hard for him to accept that what Sarah wants is not too sons that maybe will create a large nation together or will be in no hierarchical or no competition between them. And Hashem tells him, no, she's right. Now he can't sell her anymore. Neither can Sarah. We saw the Hammurabi code, but that's why he basically lets her away. He sends her to the desert, and then clears to the world, this is my son, and this is what the Am Yisrael will be coming out. I'll just say one more minute of that's not from our Haftarah, but I just want to explain that the background for this was already laid out when Ishmael was born. Because when Sarai gave Avraham her maid, it was clear. It said, there are other laws in the Hammurabi code of what happens if he takes in another wife. But he didn't just take in another wife. He took Sarah's maid. And then Sarah made it very clear what the hierarchy would be. She said, I don't have children. If I don't have a son, at least I will have an opportunity to be continued through my maid. Once she had children, the status was changed. But again, it's the Pesukim emphasized. And the Pasuk wants to emphasize this again and again to say that when they had a joint child, the situation was laid out very clearly. And Hagar was a little bit, I would say, you can call her a troublemaker because she didn't stay according to what the relationship they had laid out for. Because when she became pregnant, meaning Sarah said, she's not treating me like a mistress. She's treating me differently, which is why later, which is what we read in our Haftarah, Sarah feels like there's no way she can kind of find a middle way with this woman, because this woman already showed after Ishmael was born that she's not accepting the general rules. And if she's not accepting the general rules, then she has to be shown the door. I'm saying this because I want to say that it's hard on a little bit on Hagar, but I think it gives us more sympathy for Sarah when we understand, when we read the Haftarah, we understand what the context was, that within it, she made sure Yitzchak would get top priority. Meaning what we see is that Sarah's dominant actions, or you can even say reactions, are because she's smart enough to understand the situation. She wants to make sure that her son will really be the beginning of Am Yisrael, and there won't be any misunderstandings, and that's why she works like she works. So on the one hand, what we have here is a very private story of Hasara, but on the other hand, what we have here is a national story of how our nation became to be in the context of the ancient world. That first day, which as I said is between a private and a public story, we also read the known Haftarah of Pkidat Chana. And what Chazal do to us when they pass us from this journey from Sarah's story with, I would say, an amount of ambivalency towards, that's how I feel, the way she handled Hagar, the way she handles Ishmael, but understanding that she has a bigger picture across her. So what Chazal really do is they take us to an intimate, private story. And they say, I know you read now what it looks like to be a mother of a nation and how you can have two voices there, a private story that'll impact a larger story. But we also have private stories that really connect us to the tefillah, that connects us to, I would say, the anger that she feels, jealousy. And I think what we see when we read this Haftarah is, again, I would say, another story of a mother and son. But this time, the story doesn't end in the harsh way we saw before of Sarai telling Hagar or telling Avraham who tells Hagar, go away, which might have left us a little bit maybe feeling frustrated or sad for Hagar or emotional at the whole situation. Here, this story actually ends with first she obviously is crying, but then she swears to God that this son will be part of Beit HaMikdash, and the part I took off that comes afterwards is really her sincere prayer. So what we have here, I would say, is two stories that kind of fill in two different aspects of being I would say a mother, or having some kind of special circumstances with your son, where once we see Sarah reacting to the historical context and making sure that Yitzhak gets his dominant role. And at the other end of the story ends with Hannah's very private prayer, thanking God for the son she gave her, the son he gave her. And that's kind of how we finish the first day of Rosh Hashanah, with two private stories that obviously have non-private implications. But then when we move to the second day of Rosh Hashanah, then after going through this very, I feel, private, even emotional day, we really go to the national level. And when I say the national level, I want to say that we go to a story that really has implications for the Jewish generations, I would say, throughout all generations. So first we see the sipur of Akedat Yitzchak. And obviously we could understand Akedat Yitzchak in many different ways. That's another shiur. But I dafka want to point out to the fact that Akedat Yitzchak in our Haftarah does not end here with the words Al Tishlach Etcha El Ha'Na'ar, don't give Yitzchak as a sacrifice. It ends Kibarech Avarchecha Ve'Arbe Arbe Etzarecha Kekochvei Hashamayim VeKechol Asher Al Shpat Hayam VeYirash Tzarecha Et Shear Oyviv VeYitbarchu VeZarecha Kol Goyei Haaretz Ekev Asher Shamata BeKoli. Meaning, what we actually have here is a story that the Akedah is laying here actually ends in the, or echoes the larger bracha that comes out of this, that we're becoming from private people to a nation, that we're becoming the promise of the Zera, the promise of the continuation given to Avraham Avinu is now emphasized after Yitzchak. Now it's obviously that there, this, it's not coincidental who was born first or who was the master and who was the slave. It's clear that Sarah succeeded, and this is going to be the further nation. And then we go to another national story, which is, I would say, not less than amazing, because we go to the second day of Haftarah, and we see again Yirmiyahu relating here on a national level to the story of families. As if we have in mind, Chazal kept in mind the fact that we started with Sarah and Hagar and first Ishmael and then Yitzchak. And then we went on and we heard about Chana, and then we heard about the circumstances within Yishmael was born. And then what we see next is really the national Akedah formalizing how Yitzchak's Zera becomes a nation. And comes Yirmiyahu and gives us after that, if you go through, it has all family names. I emphasize the word lechol mishpachot Israel, because that's exactly what the journey we went through. We went through a family's story, and these stories of families become a am. And merachok Hashem li ve'avat olam ha'avtich. And here, it's interesting to see that this ahava that we see in the Torah is, you know, known for Yaakov's ahavat Rachel. And if you think of who we met Avraham and we met Yitzchak, but we didn't yet meet Yaakov. And the Haftarah alludes here very clearly also to Yaakov. We'll see, obviously, Rachel shortly. And we see the emphasis on the woman nature, Odivnech v'nivnet betulat Yisrael, Odit upayach v'yatzat b'machol, meaning Yirmiyahu is not only talking about Rachel. He's kind of closing the circle about what it means to be born through families and through the family stories that we met. So, we have the Mishpachot, we have the Ahavat Olam, we have later on the promise that this would come national. But now I want to say more than that. I want to, and we'll go back a little bit to this later, but I want to say, go to the very famous psukim about Rachel. Amar Hashem kol berama nishma nehi bechit morim. Rachel mevaka al banea meana leinachem al banea kenin. And here you can really see a closure, an amazing closure, to I would say the personal and the national, if we went through the different aspects, because it's obvious there's a personal story here. Rachel is crying, and we know very well where we met Rachel and where she was crying, and that she was, and that she never really raised her children on her own. So on one hand, we can read this as a very personal story that has to do with Rachel and her personal life. But on the other hand, this personal story becomes a national story in our Haftarah. It's not really a story about Yosef and Binyamin. This is really a story of Baneha, the general Am Yisrael. And when it says Ki Einenu, again, we have this double verse, you know, of she had a son that was Einenu, and now she has as a mother of a nation of Einenu. Ko amar Hashem, מנעי קולך מבכי ועינייך מדמעה כי יש שכר לפעולתכם עם השם ושבו מארץ אויב. It's exactly, I would say, a fulfillment to the שכר that Hashem gives Rachel, but she doesn't get the same שכר that Leah got or that we expect. What we really see is that we see she gets שכר that's on a national level. So this, and obviously Rachel מבכה על בניה מענה להנחם, Me'ana le'inachem again reminds us of Yaakov that wasn't willing to le'inachem on Yosef. So what these two verses do very, very carefully, using their very specific wording, I think, is taking Rachel from mevaka al banea to from a personal level to the general level of Am Yisrael, of the whole Am Yisrael. And the words ki einenu that allude to Yosef, Bilshon Yachid, on a singular note, become plural when we talk about the whole of Am Yisrael. And all of a sudden we see that there's redemption around the corner, because you remember Yaakov said, Hayeled Einenu, and we thought the story was coming to a closure and coming to an end. And here we see, no, the son there was also found and also here. Ve'yesh tikva la'achritech ne'um Hashem. So we're basically learning that mothers and sons end up having this personal minute of closure. And it's true for Sarah on our first day, and it's true for Hannah on the second day. And it's even true for, I would say, Yitzchak, and that which alludes obviously to Rivka, and then Yaakov to Rachel, all our Avot and Imahot. And now we learn in Rosh Hashanah on the second day that we're looking on a national level, and all of a sudden the sons become the whole of Am Yisrael. It's not only that. It's Shomo Shamati Ephraim Mitnodid Yisartani Vivaser Ke'egel Olumad Hashiveni Ve'ashuva Ke'ata Hashem Elokai. I want to remind us that Ephraim was already part of the Israel 10 tribes that were kind of given up. So when we look at the post the time the first temple was destroyed, then looking at a nevuah of Nechama and Yirmiyahu, which I know sounds like there are very many of them, but there are very, very few. Not, this is not Yishayahu, this is not Yechezkel. Yirmiyahu is very few nevuot that are really consolation, that are really Nechama. And what he's basically telling Am Yisrael is that even the place you totally gave up, even Ephraim that you really think is not something that you'll end up meeting again or seeing again, even that son will end up coming back to be part of Am Yisrael. So it's not only a closure for the stories that we read in the first day, or for the Chulban of Beit HaMikdash and the Yehuda going to exile. It's really taking us one step further and telling us we'll even see a flying back again. And not only that, you can see the last verse, Ki Achrei Shuvi Nichanti. It's not a coincidence that we kind of ask ourselves, who's saying this? Is this Hashem saying this? Is this talking first person, characterizing the parents, characterizing the feelings of Rachel? Who's the person who's Achrei Shuvi Nichanti Ve'Achrei Ivadi Sefakti Al Yerech? But what I really want to say or emphasize here is that when I called this shiur a journey through the Haftarot, what I wanted to say is we could look at each one of the Haftarot in great depth and see every pasuk and every meaning. But if we zoom out for a minute, then we see another aspect that I want to emphasize in the last few minutes, which is and I feel it's very appropriate, especially here coming from Israel, which is trying to hold together the personal and the national level. Meaning on the one hand, and I'm thinking about it now, of Rosh Hashanah, we each come and say everything we have on a personal note to Hashem. And thinking on a personal level, I can understand Sarah's gut feelings when she looks around and she wants to make sure her son has the right place. And I can definitely feel where Chana is. I can feel where Sarah is during that Kedah, even though she's not mentioned there even once. She's obviously there in the background. And I can feel how Rivka comes in later and kind of fills in a gap. And I can even feel Rachel, and I can hear about Leah, even though she's not mentioned or she's only alluded to when we speak about Ephraim. And that's a personal level. And I really think that on that level, what we learned from all these haftarot is how much each one of these women are active and take responsibility and they don't stay passive, even when it seems against all odds, even when it seems like there's nothing that can be done anymore. Even when it seems that Avraham loves, fell in love with the Ishmael and it won't work, or even when Rachel, it seems like her story ended in the worst way possible because she passed away giving birth to her son. But they are all very active. So that's one side. But on the other side, the same haftarot teach us that there's a level that's above us. And on that level, we can all of a sudden recognize that Sarah does her best, but then without Hashem interfering and telling Avraham, Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah shma bekolat, maybe it wouldn't have worked. And Chana, you know, Eli thinks she's shikora, she thinks that she's drunk. And there again, she does her best, but there's a minute where she kind of says, I'm giving this swearing to God, I'll give my son to Beit HaMikdash, but that's all I can do, and now it's up to you. And definitely in that Kedah, we don't even hear Sarah. And even Avraham, he works between this active, you know, all the Midrashim ask, why isn't he more active? Why isn't he rebelling against God with such an impossible mission? But there's this fine tuning between being active, but also being active and just accepting what you have or what's on your plate. And I think also Rachel, what do we hear about her? We don't hear at the end that she's yelling or dominating. We hear she's crying. Rachel mevakal banei me'ana leinachem. So she's dominant in one way, and she's active in one way, but she's very passive in another way. She's just sitting there quiet, crying. And I feel that that's exactly the way, at least I'm coming into Rosh Hashanah. On the one hand, you feel like we have to be active. We have to try to make this world a better place. Coming from Israel, there's a lot to do. There were many people that we missed this year that won't be with us anymore. Everyone's demonstrating all over. People are saying not nice things. The atmosphere is full of impurity and not nice words, and it's really hard. And in those ways, I feel like we should be active and try to figure out what we can do about it. But on the other hand, there's a place that I feel like all we can do is come, say slichot, pray to God, and kind of have this perspective to the future, like Rachel shows us, that things aren't always understood now, and I would say given replies or answers on the spot. A long perspective shows us that things can change over time, and that maybe sometimes all we can do is pray or cry or just be there and say that we're not forgetting and we're still asking for better. So those were my 28 minutes, Rabbi Kelvin.
Thank you. Thank you for that very moving, really conclusion. I think it's a very, powerful. Thank you. I think there is even maybe one or two comments. I think if you want to take a quick look, Alotopeno, right? That was from the last year.
Well, listen, I'm going to say that I'm differentiating between Pshat and Drash here, because the Midrashim, they do a whole lot to try to answer our questions or to fill in gaps. And I think every midrash should be read on two levels. It should be read on the first level of what was missing for Chazal that this was a story that they had to kind of give to fill in a gap. And on the other level, why did the psukim choose not to say anything of that explicitly? So I accept definitely the comment of Pnina, and I accept the comment of Bacheva, but I also want to say some of it I think is specifically not the mikre, not coincidental, left unsaid in the verses. Maybe so we have some, I would say, merchav to kind of fill in what we spaced, to kind of to fill in different options or different observations according to where we are at every time we read the chapter.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to wish you Shana Tova, all good things. We should hear good news from Israel, like you say. The